want to talk about just by way of introduction here as we get started. First of all, let me just remind you sort of the big picture of David's kingship. It really basically happens in stage one. And as you may remember, David, first of all, is made king only over Judah. And he's king in the city of Hebron, and he reigns for 7.5 years. During this same time, Saul's son Ish-bosheth has been anointed king over the rest of Israel, and he's had to cross over the Jordan River. You may be able to see on this map to a place called Mahanaim, where he reigns as king. So there's a period of division and civil war. I made the comment to you on Wednesday that although we usually call the reigns of Saul, David, and Solomon the United Kingdom, in some ways that is a misnomer, because there is division, certainly in the time of Saul when he's chasing David down as a fugitive, and as we're going to see, both before and after David becomes king over all Israel. And then as we studied on Wednesday night, David then in 2 Samuel chapter 5 is eventually acknowledged as king by both Judah and Israel. And you'll notice that the Bible historian frames it like this in anticipation of what is going to happen when Israel and Judah do split in the era that we call the divided kingdom. And we also notice that David selects Jerusalem as his capital. Anybody remember the reasons we suggested he selects Jerusalem as his capital? So first of all, no tribe has control of it. They were supposed to, of course, but they failed to conquer it. And so this way he's picking a city that no tribe can say, well, he's picking our city, so he's choosing favorites. So he's picking a city that nobody controls. And also, remember, the city of Jerusalem lies between what two tribal territories? Judah and Benjamin, which is significant because Benjamin is Saul's tribe. So if you've had this period of tension between the house of David and the house of Saul, this is one way to sort of eliminate that tension. The other thing I would just remind you of is that in 2 Samuel chapter 7, we have this great promise. And that is the promise to David that God is going to make a covenant with him, that he says, I'll make your name great. I'll appoint a place for Israel, which is Jerusalem, give you rest from your enemies, the victories that David experiences, raise up your offspring, establish your offspring's kingdom, your offspring will build a house for my name, and I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. So that's the first half of David's tenure. It's a time of great blessing and prosperity. Now, unfortunately, we come to 2 Samuel chapter 11. It says in verse 1, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle in the ancient world, the weather patterns affected when armies could fight, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And I know sometimes I have said that this was a mistake. David should have gone out and fought. He shouldn't have stayed back. That's how he got in trouble. I will say there is a story later in 2 Samuel where David wants to go fight and the men say, no, we can't afford to lose you. So that may have been a factor here. It's up for your speculation. Anyway, they're fighting with the Ammonites. David remains at Jerusalem. Verse 2 says, it happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, which seems odd to us, but in the ancient world, that was a very common way palaces were constructed, to be up on the roof. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. I want to make it crystal clear here. The text in no way, shape, or form even hints that Bathsheba deserves any blame for David seeing her. The blame is squarely on David, and the text emphasizes this by using the word sent. Do you see in verse 3, David sent and inquired about the woman, and then he finds out that this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And what do we learn about Uriah the Hittite later in the book of 2 Samuel? That is exactly right. He is one of David's mighty men, one of the 30 mighty men listed for us at the end of the book. So this is not just you know, some schmo. This is somebody who has played an integral role in fighting for David. Now, after David finds out this woman is married, and not only married, but married to one of his mighty men, he should have dropped it. And instead of dropping it, verse 4 says, he sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now, she had been purifying herself from uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. Now, I'm not going to say that Bathsheba bears no responsibility at all for engaging in this act. I will say this. In the ancient world, because of the power a king had, there is such an enormous disparity between the role of David and Bathsheba. I mean, think about it. Remember in the story of Esther, she's terrified even to go see her husband, the king, unless she goes through a bunch of hoops of royal protocol. So again, the text is going to be very clear where the blame lies here. And so then, after she returns home in verse 5, she sends word to David and says that she's pregnant. And now David has a huge problem on his hands. He's going to have to cover up this sin. Yeah, Tommy. Very good question. Tommy's asked, what tribe was Uriah? And the answer is, Tommy, that is a vicious trick question. Because he's not an Israelite. He is Uriah the Hittite. And so he is one of several foreign people who are mentioned in the story of David that fight for David. And there were advantages in some respects to this, because if Israel is caught up in this vicious civil war pitting one tribe against the other, in some ways it was an advantage to have people who were not part of any of those tribes to serve you. And undoubtedly, that's one of the reasons Uriah had been one of his mighty men. So Uriah is Hittite. That's a great question. Tommy gave me the opportunity to make that point. And we'll see other non-Israelite people groups mentioned periodically in the story that we probably won't have time to talk about a lot, but in connection with David. Great question. All right, so at this point, David is going to try to cover up the sin. So here's the first logical way. Verse 6, David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. Joab sent Uriah to David. Uriah comes, David makes small talk. Verse 8, what does David tell Uriah to do? Go home. Basically, have a good time. Expecting Uriah to do what one would naturally expect a soldier to do who's been away from his wife for a long time in the field. But instead, what does Uriah do according to verse 9? So loyal. Does not use this opportunity for his own personal pleasure. Sleeps at the door of the king's house. And when David learns about it, Uriah says in verse 11, the ark in Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live, as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Stunning loyalty to his comrades in stark contrast to David's disloyalty. And so then, the next thing David tries to do is, in verse 13, what does he do? Gets him drunk. This is, to me, one of the arguments against drinking in the Bible. David understands what we all understand, which is that alcohol lowers your inhibitions to make you want to do things that you've determined that you don't want to do. But notice that at the end of verse 13, even drunk, Uriah the Hittite does not prove disloyal. And so David decides, I'm going to have to eliminate him. If I can kill him, I can quickly marry Bathsheba, then her pregnancy will just seem like par for the course in our relationship. So he sends instructions to Joab to tell Uriah, to take Uriah to, as you know, to the hottest part of the battle, pull away, and then let Uriah be killed. So here's the picture that I chose as the title slide. If you think about it, this letter, this instruction David is going to send, this is unbelievably sensitive and delicate. If word were to get out that David is hatching a plot like this, it would bring disgrace and shame upon him. So if David is going to send this message to Joab, he's going to have to send it by the servant that he trusts above all without any qualms. And who is the servant he sends it by? Uriah, says in verse 14. And that's what this is a painting of. Uriah unknowingly becomes the bearer of his own death sentence. Ironically, because David knew he could trust Uriah so much. So, everything happens exactly as David plots. Joab sends word back to David and tells him that Uriah is dead. And if you look in 11:25, you can see a great change over David. Remember, this is the guy who starts 2 Samuel by lamenting the death of Saul, a wicked man, by saying how a prince in Israel has fallen. And when he hears about Uriah's death, what does he say in verse 25 to Joab? Don't be troubled. Hey, this kind of thing happens in war. So it shows us the great change that has taken place in the part of David. So, verse 27, when the morning was over, David sent and brought Bathsheba to his house. She becomes his wife, bore him a son. I don't think the text needed to tell us this, but just in case, the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. So the prophet Nathan comes to him, tells him a story. And this is a great way to help people see things where they might be defensive. Tell a story that establishes common ground first. And so he tells David a story about a wealthy man and a poor man. The poor man had one ewe lamb which he loved like a child. And the wealthy man has a visitor, and rather than take from his abundance, he takes away the poor man's one little ewe lamb and feeds it to his guests. And David is outraged by this, because David is a man in many respects who is righteous. In fact, he says this man deserves to die. And then he says, if you look in chapter 12 and in verse 6, how many times over should this man restore what he took from the poor man? It says four times. He should be made. And then, of course, Nathan says, you are the man. And I want you to notice the consequences that Nathan outlines for David. He says in chapter 12 and in verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you've despised me and taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. And I can't remember who it was that first pointed this out to me. I had always thought that Nathan just simply is talking about David's immediate household, like Absalom and what's going to happen. Well, he does mention that in the next part of this set of punishments. But I think actually this idea of the sword never departing from your house refers to more than just simply David's immediate family. It's telling us the whole story of the dynasty of David and the nation of Judah from here on out. And as you already know from your study of the Old Testament, with rare exceptions, the sword does not depart from Judah. There is constant conflict. The next thing he says is, in verse 11, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, which of course is going to happen with what I talked about at the table with Absalom. I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. You did it secretly. I will do this thing before all Israel and the son. And then one last consequence that David is told about here in verse 14, the child conceived with Bathsheba is going to die. And so really the rest of 2 Samuel describes for us the working out of these terrible consequences. Let me pause here before we move on and look at some of the details of those consequences as they unfold. Any questions or comments before we move on? Yeah, Jackson. Yeah, Jackson's raising the point. It's interesting to think about these in connection with the promise in 2 Samuel 7. And I really hadn't thought about that an awful lot, Jackson. That's a really good it's a really good point to open up some consideration. The main thing I had thought about in connection with the promise in 2 Samuel 7 is, you know, according to the law, literally, what should have happened to David? Yeah, he should have been executed. He's committed adultery and murder. Those are both capital crimes. But I think part of the reason that doesn't happen is because God has made these promises in 2 Samuel 7, so God is going to be faithful even when David is not. But that doesn't mean that David is going to be let off the hook. He is going to face consequences, and they are worse than death. Because as I talked about in chapter 18, David wishes he could have died instead of what takes place in the course of this story. But yeah, no, that's a great point, Jackson. Very good. All right, so then, here's how this all shakes out. There's a lot to go through here. The way the biblical writer has put this all together is really just quite a masterpiece. If we were doing just a study of 1 and 2 Samuel, we could take a lot more time to talk about the way that this story is all weaved together. But for the purposes of telling the story of the history of the nation of Israel, here are some of the key highlights. First of all, as Nathan the prophet said, the baby does indeed pass away in the rest of 2 Samuel chapter 12. And then in chapter 13, we have, I think, right up there with the terrible story at the end of Judges, one of the worst stories in the Bible. As I alluded to in my table talk, David has multiple children by multiple wives. And you may recall, we did a quick drive-by on Wednesday of that detail. And I just warned you that that detail at the end of chapter 5, that David has started to accumulate many wives and he's having many children, from the point of view of an ancient king is a sign of progress and prosperity, but from the standpoint of the will of God is a much different indicator. God specifically said in Deuteronomy 17, I don't want my kings to do this. And it's just like, it's like when you see a movie and there's just this little foreshadowing that later on you're going to realize, oh, we were being warned, terrible things are about to happen. And that's what takes place with that detail in 2 Samuel 5. So sure enough, David has multiple children by one of his wives. He has Absalom and Tamar. By another, he has Amnon. And in chapter 13, there's this horrible story in which Amnon pretends to be sick, asks for Tamar to be sent to him, and then forces himself on her. And so if you think about it, he commits sexual sin, he's involved in deception, very similar to what David has done. And maybe in part that's why David does not punish him. David is angry about this, the text says in verse 21. If you have an English Standard Version and maybe other translations, I didn't check them, you might notice that there is a footnote on verse 21 here of chapter 13 that says that David also did not want to punish Amnon because he was his firstborn. So that could possibly also be a reason here. But I will tell you who is not content with this is Tamar's full brother, who is Absalom. Absalom is an intriguing character to me. To me, the most compelling villains, like in any story, in any movie, are the villains that you understand why they became villains. Doesn't excuse what they do, but you understand why it happens. And to me, that's Absalom here. And whatever else we are to think about Absalom, I would just point this out to you. In chapter 14 and verse 27, we learn that Absalom has three sons and a daughter. And I want you to notice, what does he name his daughter? He names her Tamar. In the ancient world, his sister, by virtue of the rape of Amnon, will be considered damaged goods. She's never going to be able to marry in that culture. And she, in fact, if you go back and look in chapter 13, she dresses in the dress that indicates mourning for her virginity. She can't have a child. And so Absalom names his daughter after his sister. So it gets complicated. Sin really complicates things. And that's what you see here. So then, in chapter 13, after 2 years, it says in verse 23, Absalom hatches a plot. I don't know if he was actively thinking about this the entire 2 years or not, but after 2 years, he hatches a plot at a sheep shearing, which some of you may even have some vague memory of the olden days when various key moments of connected with agriculture or with raising animals, you might have a celebration of some kind. And that's what's going on here. And it is at this moment that Absalom hatches the plot for his brother to be murdered. And it says in verse 34 of chapter 13, he fled. He actually flees in verse 37 to his maternal grandfather's. And he goes into exile there, it says, for 3 years. Eventually, Joab actually convinces David to let Absalom come back, although even then he's kept at arm's length for 2 years. Some people have speculated if David had not kept Absalom at arm's length for 2 years, if he had immediately welcomed him back, would things have turned out differently? There's no way to know this. But eventually there is what appears to be a full restoration. And then we have the story that I started to talk about a little bit this morning, where Absalom instigates a rebellion. A couple things I would point out to you about this rebellion. Notice that in verse 7, chapter 15, at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron." Why do you think Absalom wants to go to Hebron? That is where David was first appointed king, was in Hebron. So he's going to go to where the old man was first made king. And so then in verse 9, the king said to him, "Go in peace." It's very ironic. That's the last words David ever speaks to Absalom. "Go in peace." So he arose and went to Hebron, but Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say Absalom is king at Hebron." And then you will notice that in verse 12, he sends for the other fellow that I mentioned, whose name is Ahithophel, who is David's counselor. Now, I won't take the time to trace this out, but if you look at the references in 2 Samuel that talk about the family tree of all these characters, we learn that Ahithophel is related to Bathsheba. He is Bathsheba's grandfather. And although text doesn't spell this out, what I'm guessing is that he was furious with what happened, and that's the reason why he's willing to change sides. So, chapter 15, verse 13, a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel," now notice Israel as opposed to Judah. The text is going to keep making this point about this division. "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after David," and then David says, "We've got to flee. There'll be no escape from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." You can tell that David absolutely knew what Absalom was capable of. And he knows that if this is going down, we've got to get out of here immediately. You'll also notice, going back to Tommy's excellent question a moment ago, notice in verse 18, these peoples that are mentioned going with David. What tribe, Tommy, smarty pants, what tribe do the Kerethites come from? And the Pelethites and the Gittites? Well, of course, the answer is they're not Israelites, all of them. Matter of fact, Gittites are people from Gath. Who else was from Gath? Big dude. Goliath. Yeah, so these are actually foreigners who in some respects are going to be the most loyal to David because they've never been enmeshed in all of these intertribal politics that have taken place. And so it says in verse 23, all the people wept aloud as all the people passed by, and the king crossed the brook Kidron. And then, as I said, in verse 30, the Mount of Olives. And again, reading this in light of the story of Jesus, the very path Jesus takes as he leaves Jerusalem from the upper room. And John even tells us specifically he crossed the Kidron and went up onto the Mount of Olives. So this reminds me, I was thinking about this the other night. When I was younger, I had this book called All the Messianic Prophecies of the Bible. And then I would start to think, oh, I wonder if this is a messianic prophecy. And I wonder, is this psalm messianic? And is this part of the prophet Isaiah messianic? And don't get me wrong, I do think there are some very specific, you know, predictions. Like Micah 5, he'll be born in Bethlehem, things like that. But there is a sense in which all of the Old Testament is a messianic prophecy. And what I mean by that is, remember Jesus, it says in Luke's gospel, everything written about me in the law and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. There is a sense in which, so I'm nearsighted, so I can see up close, but especially with my right eye, I really can't read any print back there on that screen. And then I put these glasses on and now I can sort of read it. Well, there's a sense in which you can't really read the Old Testament until you put Jesus on. And then when you read the Old Testament through the lens of Jesus, you see a lot of things. You see what I'm talking about here? It's like that story that I did at the table, Ethan and I were talking about. I mean, surely I've thought about this before. I mean, it's right there. It's so obvious, you know, but till somebody else pointed it out to me, I guess I never really had. But like Boaz, the Redeemer, I talked about a few weeks ago. Just some of these things, once you think about Jesus, it's like, oh, well, it's right. It's been right there all along, you know. So that's, I think, one way to read this and see this story. And by the way, it's in verse 31 that David is told that Ahithophel is among those who have rebelled against him. And he prays for the Lord to take this wonderful counsel of Ahithophel and to turn it. All right, it's very hard to pick and choose exactly what all to emphasize in this story. You all see the big points here. For you. Let me just pause here, though, before we move on to chapter 16. Any other comments or things you notice or questions you'd like to ask? Okay, I have a vivid memory of being a freshman at Florida College. And I was in my beloved mentor I talk about probably way too much, Phil Roberts' Bible class. And we were in this section right here. And I thought to myself, I've already preached in Stamping Ground, Kentucky. What do I need to do this reading today? I know the Bible. I'm not going to do my reading today. And surely if he gives us a quiz, I'll be able to answer all these questions correctly. So I go to class and we sit down and there's a quiz question that says, as David fled to Jerusalem, which of these things happened? And the one option I knew for sure was not the answer was, an old man cursed at him and threw rocks at him. Which, of course, is exactly what the answer is here. It's here in 2 Samuel 16. And I vowed that day that if I ever taught at Florida College, I would put that question to my students to make them, and I sure enough, I did. So that was all, and that'll be, if I teach it again, that'll be one of my quiz questions here. Here's the thing, though, to notice. This guy's name is Shimei, and he's described for us in chapter 16 and verse 5. What I want you to notice is, how is he identified to us? Yes, he's of the house of Saul. So when 2 Samuel 5 says that all Israel came together with all Judah and said, hey, David's the king, we shouldn't fight against each other, that doesn't mean that all those years of bitterness between Saul's people and David just suddenly evaporated. Many of those tensions still exist beneath the surface, and sometimes they don't remain beneath the surface. And you can see that here, and we'll see another example of it here in just a minute. All right, so chapter 16, verse 15. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai has volunteered to serve as a double agent for David. So he says, "Long live the king, long live the king." And Absalom said, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? You're supposed to be one of David's guys, aren't you?" And in verse 18, Hushai says, "No, I'm going to be with the guy everyone in Israel has chosen." So then Absalom says, "Give me your counsel." Verse 21, Ahithophel says, "Go into your father's concubines." Now, do you remember that Nathan said, "I'm going to raise up trouble in your own house, and I'm going to give your wives, and it's not going to be in secret. I'm going to do it publicly. Go into your father's concubines, whom he's left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you've made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, exactly what Nathan said. And Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now, I realize this obviously is gross, but this is Absalom's way of saying, "I intend to be the king, and there's no turning back." This is kind of like in Roman history when Caesar crosses the Rubicon. There's no turning back. When he brings the legions into Italy against Rome, you know what, there's going to be trouble. And that's what Absalom is doing here as well. Now then, in chapter 17, there's this debate between Hushai and Ahithophel. Ahithophel says, "Well, what you tell me?" Verse 1, what does he advise David to do? Absalom to do. Second Samuel, chapter 17. He says, "Let's get after it right now. Chase him down right now," because think about it. He knows David's disorganized, on the run, panic. "Let's just take care of him right now. Strike while the iron is hot." Hushai, though, remember, working for David, says this. Verse 7, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." He says, "You know, your father's probably hiding, and he's the valiant men will melt in fear. They know that your father's a mighty man." So he says in verse 11, "But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba as the sand of the sea by multitude, and that you go to battle in person." So let's get everybody all together. Very grandiose. And Absalom says, "That sounds like a good plan to me." And I want you to notice what the text tells us, that when Ahithophel learns that David is going to take Hushai's counsel instead of his, what does chapter 17, verse 23 tell us? He kills himself. Why does he kill himself? Remember, Ahithophel is very wise. When he sees that Absalom is not going to strike immediately, when David is most vulnerable, guess what he's figured out? He knows they're doomed. They're going to be defeated. And so he takes his own life. Yeah. So also, incidentally, notice in verse 24, where does David go? He goes to this place, Machanaim, the very same place when the house of Saul was on the run, that they had to flee. Just one of these interesting little history kind of repeats itself. In any event, chapter 18 tells us now about the showdown that's going to take place. In verse 6, "So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim." Perfect terrain for David's battle-hardened veterans. Remember, they've been on the run in the wilderness for years. And it says in verse 8, "The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And among the people it devoured is Absalom." Now, when I was a kid, what I thought the Bible was describing is, because we know that Absalom has a couple of noteworthy features. He's very handsome. I didn't talk about this, but hopefully you remember some of these details. And what else is noteworthy about Absalom? Yeah, he's got big hair. So when I was a kid, I kind of thought that Absalom's going along and his hair gets all tangled up in the branches. And maybe that's because it's like a weird psychological profile, because my granny's favorite choice of discipline was to grab my long hair, and I had really long hair when I was a kid, so my mom didn't want to cut too much of my shame and disgrace in the neighborhood, and granny would just grab my hair and pull it. But it's not what the text describes. It says that his head got cut. You can imagine in the darkness of a forest, in the panic of battle, it's actually like he gets wedged up into the tree. And then, of course, as I talked about in the table talk today, he's discovered. And even though he specifically gives orders, David had specifically given orders to deal gently with Absalom and to spare him, Joab has no use for these orders and immediately goes and begins the process in verses 14 and 15 of killing Absalom. And so Absalom dies, and the word gets back to David. There's so many things you could go to here. You could also think of the parable of the prodigal son and just put it right in here. David looking to see what's going to happen, waiting for answers to come back. There's a lot of things to think about here, but certainly that mournful cry, "Oh Absalom, my son, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son." Yeah, Jackson. Yes, Jackson's raising the point that Joab was the one kind of responsible at the urging of a wise woman to bring Absalom back, and now he's also responsible for killing Absalom. So you can see that when my good friend Ralph Walker and I, when we have our epic debate, you can see how he's going to try to spin this, and you'll see how I will counter with the truth, of course. But yeah, no, that is an interesting connection. You know, something I didn't talk about today in the table talk that you could also bring up in connection with a contrast between Absalom and Christ. Do you notice that it says in chapter 18 and verse 17 that he was thrown in a pit and raised over him a great heap of stones? So he's buried and stones cover him. Jesus is put in a tomb protected by a stone, but the stone is rolled away. Once you start thinking about it, there's a lot of these kind of things that are going to come on. All right, the key thing I want to also point out here before we totally run out of time today, even with this heart-rending situation with Absalom, David's problems are not over. So just two chapters later, look in chapter 20. It says in verse 1, "Now there happened to be a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri." And what tribe is he from? A Benjamite. "And he blew the trumpet and said, 'We have no portion in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel.'" So I won't go into the rest of the detail about this. I just wanted you to see that this penalty that Nathan said was going to happen, that the sword will not depart from David's life, it goes beyond just his immediate household, and it's going to continue. Now, I want to tell you something that I thought I came up with this. I thought I was the first person to ever notice this. And then, of course, you read that commentators like 7,000 years ago already noticed this long ago. Do you remember what did the prophet Nathan, when the prophet Nathan goes to David and tells him the story about the two men with the lambs, do you remember what did David say the restitution should be? Fourfold. How many children of David have been effectively lost because of his sin? The baby conceived with Bathsheba dies. Tamar is put to perpetual virginity after the terrible attack of Amnon. Amnon is killed, and now Absalom is killed. So as it turns out, David did in fact pay a fourfold price for what takes place with Uriah. I remember when I lived in Nashville, I was there, you know, for 8.5 years. For about 7 of those years, I taught a Bible study at an assisted living place that one of our members was in. I loved doing that study because it helped me to learn so much about teaching to folks who you're going to have to take your time and be patient, you know, and that's a really good thing to learn when you're a teacher. And I'll never forget, there was a precious lady there whose name was Anne, who had read part of the story of 2 Samuel, and she was, 1 and 2 Samuel, and she was troubled by the fact that Saul was punished by God like he was for the sins he committed, which essentially, in chapters 13 and 15 of 1 Samuel, both involve offering sacrifices he should not have, which seems like small change compared to what David does. And so I remember talking with her about this and just making the point, before you pronounce judgment on the equity of how David is treated versus Saul, you need to read the whole story. And once you read this whole story and you see the nightmare of what happens here in David's family, there's a lot of things you can say, but I don't think you could say that David got away with anything here. He paid a terrible price for what he did here. There's been a couple times since I've been here at Valrico that I've preached on these passages. If you want to go listen in more detail, I'm sure all of you old timers remember the second sermon I preached. The day that I came to try out was on the story of Amnon and Tamar, because something like this had just happened back home in the little community where we lived in Tennessee, and it had been fresh on my mind, and I decided to preach on it that night. I'm sure you all remember that sermon, right? And I don't remember it because I just remember that day was such a wonderful day. And then I have preached on the story of David and Bathsheba, and I would encourage you, the downside of trying to get through as much as we are is we just don't have a lot of time to do a lot of application. But please think about the applications you can make in your life in the Lord, and certainly if you have an opportunity, want to go back and search for some of these lessons, you should be able to easily find them on our website, and think about some things that we can learn. Even a man after God's own heart can make terrible mistakes and pay a terrible price, and it's best if you can to learn from others' mistakes so that you can avoid the pain of having to learn from your own. All right, well, Lord willing, we'll pick up on Wednesday. By the way, just to let you all know, Wednesday, most likely I will be not in a state to be able to come and teach class, although, frankly, I think it would be pretty entertaining to see me try to teach class still doped up from the colonoscopy that morning. That actually could be pretty exciting. And then if everything goes okay, and I shouldn't have any problems with it, I told you all this, a busy spring and summer, I'm supposed to drive up for a weekend meeting up in beautiful, actually, I don't know if it's beautiful. It could be ugly, Martinez, Georgia. But either way, I'll be up there for just a couple days this weekend. But boy, do we have an all-star lineup of people to speak and preach while I'm gone. You just won't believe it. So, but anyway, if you keep me in mind over the next few days with tests and travel, I'd sure appreciate it.